More than 80% of K-12 teachers in the United States are white, but they don't always see how race impacts what they're doing in the classroom or what's happening with their students. Talking about this can make some teachers uncomfortable, but Professor Rich Milner says we must talk about race if we want to give all of our students the education they deserve. Avoiding the subject, he says, is borderline malpractice.
Just imagine an oncologist not studying an aspect of cancer. Because it doesn't make the oncologist feel good. It makes the oncologist feel uneasy. Forget that. Like, this work is raced. And if you're going to do work that is emancipatory, if you're going to engage work that is transformative, if you're going to engage work that meets the needs of every young person with whom you work, then you've got to consider race.
From the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT, this is Teach Lab, a podcast about the art and craft of teaching. I'm Justin Reich. Today, H. Richard Milner IV, or Rich. He's a distinguished professor of education at Vanderbilt University, Peabody College of Education and Human Development, and one of the country's leading thinkers on opportunity-centered teaching. Harvard Education Press just published the second edition of his landmark book, Start Where You Are, But Don't Stay There, Understanding Diversity, Opportunity Gaps, and Teaching in Today's Classroom. The book details five mindsets teachers should adopt to be more effective educators. Thinking about race explicitly is just one of them. Rich wanted to be a teacher since he was a kid. His parents never went to college, but they made sure Rich and his siblings did. Rich got his first teaching job at a high school in South Carolina, where he grew up. He taught a group of culturally diverse students who live below the poverty line. Rich went on to earn a PhD from The Ohio State University. But it was those early days in the high school classroom that inspired his first insights into teaching.
What I continued going back to was this notion that if students don't believe you give a darn about them, you give a doggone about them, as my grandmother would say, like, they are real talk. Not going to engage with you. I don't care how young you are. I don't care what your race or ethnic background happens to be, what your sexual orientation happens to be. You got to be in a place, right, where your students know you care about them. And so that was like—
And then maybe they'll think about all these books and
absolutely.
Poems you want them to
and
read.
It's not something you check off on the box, right? It's not something that you do and say, oh, I've done that part. Like, it's like, it was like this constant engagement. And that was one of the biggest pieces that I learned from my work. It was about how do we co-create an ethos, an environment such that everyone, that all of us are able to engage in this space in whole ways. And so, you know, I did the PhD program at The Ohio State, and I began my career here at Vanderbilt. And I started immediately teaching. One of the first courses I taught was a class called Social and Philosophical Aspects of Education. And what it really meant, it was a sociology class that was a required course for all of our undergraduate secondary education majors.
Everybody who wants to become a teacher,
everybody
a secondary teacher.
Absolutely. And so we were... And so I had these students in the class, and again, just like teaching high school, the students will tell you if you listen, right, and if you're engaged with them, as educators, if we approach our work in ways such that we understand very deeply we're not the arbiters of knowledge, that we truly are in spaces where we are learning with the folks with whom we're working. If you listen and you're astute, you'll figure out along the way what's needed and what's required. So the class really became, in a lot of ways, like the multicultural checkoff class. I'm just going to be frank, because some of that I embody, you know, as the Black guy. But in the languaging and the discourse that I experienced from the teacher educate the students in the college classroom was really one of deficits. They had great intentions. They were good young folks, right, who had good hearts. But they also they embraced this idea of achievement gaps, and this idea of achievement gaps really was consistent with what we know about really placing the locus of control on students. So if students just worked harder, if families just valued education, and these were young folks, 18, 19 year olds coming into this classroom, into the teacher education classroom, really believing in their core, right? If things change with the students, then things would get better. And so when I wrote Start Where You Are,
which is your first book that you published in 2010.
And so when I wrote Start Where You Are, But Don't Stay There, I was really looking for a text that would do for me what I thought I needed in that class. So I thought, you know, if I could get my 17 or 18 students in this class and my mom to read this book,
then that'd be pretty good.
Yeah, that'd be pretty, you know, pretty darn good.
And the core idea that you were trying to wrestle with was, here are these young, mostly white students who are coming into the education profession. And say more about what you mean by deficit thinking. Like, what are some of the characteristics of deficit thinking if we wanted to be able to recognize it with teachers or education students that we were talking to?
Absolutely. So, you know, really focusing on in a very fundamental way on what students, people, community don't bring. You know, and so when you think about a checking account, right? You don't want your checking account in the deficit, I can tell you that, right? Or your bank account or whatever. So it's really about the sort of it's really about focusing in on, honing in on either consciously or implicitly, covertly, on what communities don't bring into learning environments. And what we know for sure from good science is that when mechanisms are in place to support our young people, they succeed. And so I really wanted the teachers in our class to think about how they needed to change, right? In order to build the kind of learning opportunities that would maximize student potential.
It's great. And so Start Where You Are is sort of organized around this idea of deficit. And does it use the language of asset thinking as the kind of converse of that?
Absolutely. Yes.
Whereas instead of seeing students as and their communities as missing all these things, saying, wow, there's all kinds of funds of knowledge that are here in these communities. There's all kinds of things that we can draw on as strengths to be able to build from. And it's our job as educators both to find, to see those in our students, to have the same kind of imagination for our students that your mentors had for you. And then to build the structures that we need for people to be successful. I don't know if you can, I'm sure you worked with lots of education students and then practicing educators. Do you have stories or things that you can share with us that are like where you feel like this really clicked, where the sort of changes that you saw with people as the ideas from Start Where You Are But Don't Stay There sort of took root within particular classes or communities or things like that?
Absolutely. So one of the things that's important to remember, Justin, is that when I was working with these young folks in teacher education, I was also conducting research in K-12 classrooms. And so I wanted to make sure I was studying, really looking at getting my head around what it meant for English language arts teachers I was an English teacher, but what it meant and what it looked like for English language arts teachers to engage in this work that was emancipatory. This work that what I call and what I now talk about in my work as opportunity-centered teaching, right? And so I was studying practices in K-12. I started when I first moved to Nashville and I started my work at Vanderbilt. I was working in high school English classrooms. And so I did that work for a year. And then what I realized was that I really wanted to think about a trajectory and to think broader. And so I started my work at a middle school. And I actually did some work in a social studies classroom. And, you know, I found myself really trying to hone in on educators who were successful and who were demonstrating, if you will, the kinds of mindsets that I thought were necessary for them to be successful with children who live below the poverty line, with Black and brown children, with children who have quote-unquote learning disabilities. And I remember there was a moment when there was a shooting that had taken place in this middle school where I was working. And this actually made national news. So this shooting occurred, and these were three high school students that had gone into this mom and pop shop, and they actually shot the store clerk, and the store clerk died. And so when I got to the campus the following week, on the bus yard, the students were talking about the robbery. In the corridors, they were talking about the robbery. But when I visited classrooms, the teachers didn't mention it, you know, first period, second period, third period, when I eavesdropped as good researchers do, in the cafeteria, in the lunchroom, there was no conversation about the robbery. And I just thought, but the students were
talking about this,
talking about in their hearts and minds, they were trying, and they were posing questions like young people do, right? You know, I wonder where they got where did they get the gun?
The gun. Why do they do this? What's going to happen to them?
Right?
Yeah.
You know, no discussion of it in the classroom. And so as part of my reciprocity with these teachers who had given so much of their time to help me learn about their practices, I conducted professional development with them from time to time. And so during the professional development session a few weeks later, I just posed a question, one of the questions. And this was not something that was necessarily planned, but I thought, you know, I'll get some good feedback to understand this. And it became the whole professional development session. So I asked, I said, hey, you know, I'm wondering why I didn't hear any discussion or any connections about the robbery in the class, right? In classes that I observed. And when I say the people in the teachers in their room, like all collectively just countered my question, they were offended. How dare you even pose such a question? And I was trying to get my head around, wait a minute, your students are coming in, and when you think about their hearts and minds, they're trying to get their heads around what's happened, and you're avoiding it, right? So, and the kinds of things I, you know, heard were things like, I'm not trained as a counselor. I'm not trained as a social worker. I have a real curriculum to teach, Rich Milner. Go back up there to that university. You know, all things that I understand and I get to get my, you know, I don't think parents would appreciate our having, you know, my talking about a robbery. What would the superintendent, all these things that we grapple with as educators, right? And we grapple with, and when we miss the opportunity to be responsive to our young folks, right? And so, and then there was a teacher who, if I set my computer up on the left side of the library, he sat on the right side of the library as far away from me as possible. If I set my computer up on the right side of the library,
he's on the left side.
He sat on the left side of the library as far away from me as possible. He never said one word to me the entire time I was conducting my research in the school. I remember one day, this may be a little bit of a tangent, but I'm going to tell it anyway. I remember one day I was standing by the door, and that's because I thought, he's going to talk to me. Everybody likes me, right? And when he realized what I was doing, he went back to his table and set his laptop up. He just would not engage with me. But on this day, he raised his hand. He said, you know, and I was like, come with it. I want to hear what you have to say, right? He said, and furthermore, I teach math, you know, and science. What in the world does a pathetic robbery have to do with my teaching math and science, right? And so the sort of focal area of the professional development was, you know, ways to build the curriculum to be responsive to young people. So I said, well, let's think about it for a moment. I said, what if you had your young people, your students, one more thing I need to add. Mm-hmm. And then there was one teacher who said to me, and the robbery won't show up on the test. That's the real deal of what we're grappling with. You know, in schools, teachers are under an enormous amount of pressure to teach the test, an enormous amount of accountability pressures, right? That might seem tangential to what the real curriculum is supposed to be.
It's a great summary you have of all of these different voices expressing a whole bunch of the things that are central to teachers thinking that, you know, what's the assessment and the accountability? What am I sort of trained to do? What's my role as a teacher versus my role as a person with relationships with students? What's my particular curriculum? And it's just a great sort of overview of ways in which people you know, find ways to push back against some of these ideas of, you know, equity teaching and culturally responsive teaching. But you're up there, you're in front of them, you've heard all their concerns. And then what'd you say?
Well, the first thing is I wanted to acknowledge to the teachers that I hear them. And I understand that while we can be critical of their practices, the reality is I work at the university. And I can come in and be critical and go about my life, but I really try sincerely to empathize with, to honor the folks in those communities and their real experiences. But the question that the teacher posed, the math and science teacher posed, was a real serious one, right? What in the world does a pathetic robbery, I'll never forget it, have to do with math and science? And so I said, one of the criticisms in the newspapers was that there had taken the responders too long to get, or they, you know, where they were questioning the number of minutes it had taken the police and the ambulance to get to the robbery site. Right. I said, so what if you had, they had all this great technology in the school. So I said, what if you asked the teachers to, you pulled up Google Maps and you guesstimated the amount of time it take the robbers to the responders to get from their site to the robbery site. There's some math in that, right? There are probably some standards embedded in that distance, rate of speed, you know, all these mathematical. And I said, that might even show up on the test,
right? Yeah.
You know, train A leaves the station at, you know, at one time driving a particular rate of speed, you know, so, and they kind of calmed, you know, I got them to smile a little bit when I shared that story. I said, well, what if you had on a very basic level, crime had been a concern in the community. I said, what if you asked the students to measure or to count the number of streetlights in the community, and to look at data regarding well-lit spaces versus spaces that are not as well-lit, and look at correlation. Like, are there more robberies, or is there more crime in spaces that are lit in comparison? You know, there are some data points there. There's some math there. I said, what if you had the students think about communities that have decent paying jobs in comparison to communities that don't have decent paying jobs and what crime rates are in those communities. I mean, these are the kind, what if you, you know, how long does it take people to get to the bus or to public transportation to get to decent paying jobs? All these questions that our young people are probably thinking about. Right. But we choose, or we may choose, not to engage in schools or the kinds of. And so I was able to sort of talk about probability, and I was able to talk about, you know, distance and rate of speed and all of the things that we're supposed to be teaching anyway.
As an English teacher, you came up with all this.
As an English teacher. Right. But again, and it's not that math teachers don't want to teach rate of speed, right? Or math teachers don't want to teach probability. But if you're going to connect with young people, you've got to connect with young people where they are, right? And you have to help them understand. And so the point was not that they teach a robbery, right? The point was that you teach, you know, the standards, you teach concepts, ideas, right, that connect to the human spirit, that connect with who young people are. And then I said, what if, right, the math teacher actually talked to the ELA teacher? Imagine that, right? If we set up teaching spaces where young people, where teachers could engage with each other, right? And I said, what if, you know, the literacy teacher, the English language arts teacher, were to ask her students to write a letter. At the time, our police chief was Ronald Surpass, to say, here are the things that we found in our community, and draw from data. You know, there have been, you know, X number of robberies in our community, and to not only outline what the issues are, but to talk about some of the potential strategies. So while you're gentrifying all these areas and you're moving in and pushing people out, and these are, when you talk about deficits, students are coming in with these questions. Mm-hmm. So using the questions, the assets, the ideas, the areas that pique our young folks' interests as an anchor to good teaching is what I was trying to convey to those people in service.
What did those folks do afterwards?
Well,
they probably kept doing whatever they were doing. Yeah.
I hope they made a difference. But yeah. But one of the things I did find was the gentleman who never would talk to me started talking to me after that, right? He started asking me questions and for references and tools and resources that he might be able to incorporate in onto his work.
So one part of that story is that when you really listened to teachers who were pushing back on you, and you took their concerns seriously and you took them as coming from a place of professionalism, that kind of opened them up to being able to say, okay, this Rich Milner guy, you know, he's pushing some ideas that might not align with my thinking right now, but he's really listening to me as I'm responding to them. And that creates an opportunity for dialogue with our colleagues and invites people into the conversation.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think, I believe when you're in the midst of doing the work, it can be challenging to think about innovative, outside-the-box ways of connecting content with students. And you need critical partners. We all need people to push and also show us possibilities, you know, related to what could be. And so that's part of what I think professional development can do. And that's also part of what I try to do when I am engaging with educators in a very serious way. Because let me tell you something, like for our children, for our students, like it's a matter of life and death for many of them. So, you know, standing up, lecturing, standing up, engaging with young people in the way that you teach your own children, the way that you learn, you as an educator, like that's not good enough. It's not. Like, you've got to teach the folks in front of you. And so, like, being very, compassionate and open to teachers about where they are, like, is part of it. But it's also, like, pushing, like, you can't stay there. Like, if you're committed to these folks in front of you, and, like, that's where I get, like, completely, like, very, very serious, then you got to do some things differently. If you're teaching, you know, fourth grade, and your children are not reading on a fourth grade level, guess what? Your children can't do independent study, right? You've got to teach, right? And so it doesn't matter if 70% of your students in the class get it, right? If those 30 don't, your responsibility is to teach and to bring those 30%. Where they need to be in ways that they're whole, that they understand that they have value, that they understand their own identity spaces in ways that can be transformative.
Rich, part of your work that I know best is around this set of educator mindsets that's kind of gives a landscape scan of a bunch of ways that teachers think about or don't think about, talk about or don't talk about race or structural inequality. Can you tell us a little bit, sort of an overview of what the educator mindsets are?
Absolutely. So I really wanted to create an opportunity for the teachers with whom I was working to understand very deeply how they could contribute to what I classified as opportunity gaps, or how they could actually sort of disrupt them. And so when we talk about the framework, when I was able to pull together those five tenets, these were like the five anchors that I thought if I could get teachers to understand this as a foundation for what it means to be innovative, for what it means to be responsive, then we have a better shot. We have a good chance, a better chance at the kinds of classrooms where students want to be, you know.
So asset and deficit thinking is one of those five tenets that we try to, you know, and I think what you just said actually is really helpful, because it's not about erasing all notions of deficit from your mind. At some point, we notice there are 30% of my kids who are not on grade level, and that's something that I have to do with it. But I cannot always see those 30% of the kids. They can't just be the kids who aren't on grade level. They have to be these kids who have all of these assets and strengths and speak second languages, speak more languages than I do, have cultural funds of knowledge they bring, and I need to work with them on reading.
That's absolutely
part of their identity. But asset and deficit is one of this sort of five-part framework that you have around educator mindsets. Can we talk about the other four sort of briefly? What was the second one that you worked on, or what's sort of after asset and deficit thinking, what was the next one that caught your attention and interest?
Right. And so, and I don't want to talk about these linearly, but I do want to suggest that they are interrelated. And, you know, one of them was related to this notion of race and colorblindness. And so when you start talking to teachers, to educators, many of whom are in the professional because they have good hearts, chances are they know they aren't going to get wealthy. You start talking about race and emotionally charged, you know, issues related to race, people get very offended. But it's so necessary. If you look at every indicator in education, to do analyses, deep analyses, and to advance the work and not have a race as a factor, as a variable, or whatever, however you choose to talk about your research and your work, I think is borderline. I want to say it's borderline malpractice, right? And not to pathologize the work we're doing with young people, but you know, just imagine an oncologist not studying an aspect of cancer because that oncologist feels. It doesn't make the oncologist feel good. It makes the oncologist feel uneasy. Forget that. Like, this work is raced. And if you're going to do work that is emancipatory, if you're going to engage work that is transformative, if you're going to engage work that meets the needs of every young person with whom you work, then you've got to consider race. And so as a part of the framework, race becomes one of the tenets. What we know from good science, for instance, is that students' racial and ethnic identity, so their sense of racial and ethnic identity, is strongly linked to their performance. So in other words, if I feel strongly about my own racial and ethnic identity, I do better. Not when I hate people outside of my racial and ethnic identity, but when I feel strongly about my own. And, you know, one of the things that I always say, and I used to say it was, like a conspiracy theory. But as I've tried to really test and look deeply about why white students are performing at higher rates on these tests that are predetermined by a human being, right? Then, you know, we feed white students all the time with positive feedback about who they are. So white students walk in confident. They walk in, you know, reflected in the curriculum, seeing themselves embodied in the teachers, you know, in the language that's used, the discourse, the jokes that's told. It's all, you know, they're privileged, they're advantaged just when they walk, just by virtue of walking into the space. And so, in other words, race and colorblindness is one tenet. I could go on and on and on
about each of them. Good. And the summary of it is sort of we want to that when educators shy away from acknowledging the importance of race in their work, when they bring a colorblind perspective, that often doesn't lead to work that's as sophisticated, as real, as meaningful as when they take seriously the notion that people in schools have different racial identities, and we have to be able to talk about and think about those racial identities and ways in which sort of racist practices, racist structures may be affecting their learning.
So the framework in general, right, is this notion that when educators don't embrace, when they don't understand, and then when they have a colorblind or a race neutral mindset, they contribute to opportunity gaps.
And so the next part of the framework, we had deficit thinking, we had colorblindness.
Yes. And so a third tenet, you know, related to this work really is about what I call myth of meritocracy, right? And it is a sociological construct that we've known a lot about. But a lot of the young people, a lot of the teachers with whom I was working who were learning to teach, they actually adopted or they came in with this fallacy, right? This notion that they'd earned and their families had earned their sort of rightful place of privilege. And so I really had to sort of disrupt and help them understand how systems sort of perpetuated, you know, the status quo. So, you know, I would give an example, for instance, about how generationally, you know, wealth is passed down, let's say, from one generation to the next. And so that, I think, was a really important space. And it is an important space for young people to think about socioeconomic status, to think about poverty, and to think about poverty not as a sort of descriptor or a way of describing people as much as it is a condition.
And then when those young teachers get those ideas, how do you hope they implement them in their classroom? Like when a teacher is doing work to give up on the myth of meritocracy, like what does that teacher look like in a different way in their classroom as they grow in this work?
I think that's a very important question, because I think some people not misuse, but they don't actualize the framework in ways that I think they really could. But most of the time, what happens when people engage the tenants is they will say, oh, wow, you know, I got my team to really talk about race, or I got my team to really reflect about deficit mindsets, right? This work is about how do you transform your teaching, right? So I want you to talk about race, but I also want you to think about how instructionally you're going to build instructional tools to talk about racial inequity, how you're going to build instruction. So what that means for let's say a social studies teacher is, you know, very, very easily you can talk about how neighborhoods are organized and how they've historically been organized to maintain the status quo. You can talk in mathematics about how historically particular groups of people have been denied loans and what it means to be given inequitable interest rates on how, I mean, the
cost of a mortgage in one neighborhood versus the cost of a mortgage in another, kind of thing.
So if you think about, like, there are so many ways to think about this work beyond just having a conversation, right? And so when you talk about meritocracy, you can look historically at how wealth is passed along from one generation to the next, and how these systems are in place in a lot of ways to maintain the status quo. So these are concretized examples about what it means. And young people know implicitly that something is going on, right? So, you know, this idea that somehow we are holding something, you know, over, or we're keeping something from young people that they don't quite understand. Well, using the classroom space, starting at a young age, to really help young people think about how they can address and really disrupt these systems, if you will, is really what the framework is trying to get at. And that's what I call opportunity-centered teaching, moving away from the opportunity gaps.
Is it helping that, you know, that one ultimate aim is helping students imagine themselves as people who can make change in these structural
Absolutely.
Inequalities, that they've through their teachers, they've learned both how to understand them and then some tools for thinking about how do we change and make better the world around us?
Absolutely.
Okay, there are two more tenets, and I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about them.
The fourth tenet is what's known as context-neutral mindsets. And so in this simplest form, teachers are teaching in a particular place at a particular time or particular people. And so, you know, going into spaces and really thinking about what the work means in an urban school context might look qualitatively different than in an environment that's rural or a suburban community, right? And so really teasing out and peeling back, not in a stereotypical way, but really let me build my tool kit way, right? To understand that if I'm working in a rural community, I've got to understand the history of that place. I've got to work with the community to deeply understand not only what I read in the newspapers, but to understand that everything has an historical arc, that every community has a history that is central and germane to what it means to do community. So context neutral mindset, the opposite of that is really context centered, and a context centered approach, right? Which means that when you think about, and I'll use like the closing of schools, let's say across this country, across this nation, right? And people, you know, rationalize and say, well, you know, it's the building is dilapidated, or the enrollment is down, right? What does that mean for community when we shut down the schools, or when libraries are not in those spaces, or when, you know, so really thinking very deeply on a sort of structural way, but also in terms of a micro level, like what does it mean to teach in this place right now?
In a way that would be different from teaching some other place, some other community. Absolutely. Who exactly are my kids, the families that were here? Absolutely. How do I know about them beyond? And how it's, you know, one way I've heard it said is not just that I teach math, which you do, but you teach kids math. And those, each of those kids is different, has a particular background, and we've got to find ways of sort of weaving where they come from and where they're living and what they care about and what's going on in their community into math or science or social studies.
Absolutely. And I would add to that, but, you know, this also, when your young people leave that school, those four walls, and they walk home, you know, what are they walking to and through? Right. That's what understanding the context and understanding the community and the ecology of the place really is about. Right. And so that's the fourth tenet of the framework. And then the last tenet of the framework is about what I call cultural context. Understanding cultural conflicts is the last tenet of the framework. And I tease race out of culture, because if what I found was that when we talk about culture, we talk about cultural practices, we tend to talk about cultural practices, and we'll talk about language all day, we'll talk about religion, we might talk about different value systems and so forth, and race would be left out as, you know, either superficially engaged or not talked about at all. And so when I developed the framework, I really wanted to make sure race was central, because I would argue that race is probably the most important aspect of the work we do when we talk about engaging inequitable practices.
So your argument was that if teachers in schools feel more comfortable talking about some elements of diversity over others, that we find ways to talk about religious diversity or language diversity or other kinds of things. And then there's a special taboo in America about race. And it's inauthentic to talk about some of these other cultural differences without including, you know, sort of how race is interwoven among those kinds of things. Is that the way to understand the fifth dimension? Mm-hmm. In the places that have done the, in your view, the best, most exciting work with these educator mindsets, when they're weaving together asset framing, opportunity-centered thinking, thinking about, allowing race to be a central part of the conversations that's happening amongst teachers with students in schools, what do some of those changes look like? What are some of the stories that get you most excited about continuing doing this work?
Right. Yeah. So one of the things I want to say about cultural conflicts just before we move on is that sometimes when we talk about culture, we talk about culture as something that is ingrained in a person. And I want to be clear here that a lot of what I talk about and what I've found to be most useful in this work is when we talk about cultural practices, right? Because cultural practices, what can happen is teachers can build their toolkit, right? They can become more astute at understanding issues of equity, of understanding diversity, and somehow think they've sort of taken, you know, big steps forward. But they have to understand that this work never ends and it's ongoing. And so, you know, it's just like, just because I learn how to speak Spanish, right, doesn't mean I'm a part of the culture. Does that make sense? So as a cultural practice, I might be able to speak Spanish, but folks might not. The people in that community may see me still as an outsider, right? So that piece is very important.
It's about understanding, adapting, and finding appropriate ways for you to engage in other parts of that culture. To think about, you know, which traditions do I want to participate in, and you know, the La Rambla, the afternoon walk in Spanish culture, or beyond language, religion,
and
other.
And it may not even be. It may be even inappropriate for you to move into that space. But the point is for you to really, as educators, for us really to understand, embrace, and to create the kinds of environments such that people feel whole, students feel like their cultural practices are accepted, and allow them to be who they are and not have to check so much of who they are at the door when they walk into schools. Schools are created to do exactly what they're doing, and that is to maintain the status quo for white people. And so, really disrupting that is what's necessary for us to see change.
Well, I think what's so powerful about your contribution is that these educator mindsets give us a map and a blueprint of some of this territory. I think so much of what's important and powerful about what you've offered is that if we do want to have communities of teachers that are collectively embracing the challenge of creating schools that are healing and whole places for all students, if the starting point is, well, I'm not sure how I do that, we say, well, here are these five educator mindsets. Here are five conversations that we can start having. Here are five sets of practices that we can start engaging in that can lead us towards this really important work of having schools that are not on a school-to-prison pipeline, but having schools that create the kinds of opportunities that you described at the beginning of this interview, where there are a whole bunch of people in your life who saw the talent, who saw the opportunity in you and helped open a series of doors. And we want all teachers to be doing that for all kids. Absolutely. Well, this has been incredibly powerful, Rich. Thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Justin.
That was Rich Milner, a distinguished professor of education at Vanderbilt's Peabody College of Education and Human Development. Harvard Education Press has just published the second edition of his landmark book, Start Where You Are, But Don't Stay There: Understanding Diversity, Opportunity Gaps, and Teaching in Today's Classrooms. Rich has been enormously influential in how folks in our lab think about issues of bias, inequality, justice, and great teaching. In fact, we're incredibly fortunate that Rich is joining us as a co-instructor for our upcoming course on edX, Becoming a More Equitable Educator. You've been listening to Teach Lab from the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT. I'm Justin Reich. You can learn more about Rich Milner and his work at our website, teachlabpodcast.com. That's teachlabpodcast.com. There you'll find lots of stuff, including links to our upcoming free online course on edX, Becoming a More Equitable Educator, co-taught with Rich. We hope you'll join us. You can also check out our YouTube channel, Teaching Systems Lab, where you'll find the full video interview from this episode and even more video content from our online courses. All of our work is licensed under a Creative Commons agreement, and we encourage you to use it and share. Next time, we'll talk with Mira Levinson, a professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, someone working to build a new field called educational ethics as a kind of cognate to the field of bioethics, practical, philosophical, ethical advice for teachers working in the trenches. That's next time on Teach Lab. This episode was produced by Amy Corrigan and Garrett Beasley, edited by Kate Ellis. It was recorded by Garrett Beasley and mixed by Corey Schreppel. It was filmed by Dinesh McAdoo. We'll see you next time.